You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
If you fire me, we're through. It isn't the job, I don't mind that. But it just goes to show me how much you care.
Well, you know how much
How much you what? Are you letting me go?
You do not say no to Barbara Stanwyck.
You could try, but good luck. That's from 1933's Babyface, a notorious artifact from Hollywood's pre-code era, and it's the first film in our six-part Stanwyck marathon.
Also this week, our 30s movie starter pack. That and more.
How much do you care, Adam?
Ahead on Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting. Later in the show, we revisit one of our favorite top fives from recent years, our 1930s starter pack. It's for anyone who has always wanted to dig deeper into a movie decade filled with treasures, but didn't know where to begin. These movies are classics. They're relics, you might say, Josh, just like that top five list coming from the pandemic era when we needed fodder for shows and we knew that folks at the time had a little bit more free time on their hands and could go on nice cinematic tours like this. We tried to help.
Yeah, we were no longer keeping up with every weekend's release because we didn't get new releases every weekend. So we did a little looking into the past. We thought that this starter pack would be the perfect pairing with the beginning of our Barbara Stanwyck marathon. We're kicking that off this week with 1933's Babyface. It's one of Stanwyck's early films that is credited with propelling her to stardom in the 30s. It's also credited, along with a handful of other films, with putting an end to the so-called pre-code era and moving us into the enforcement of the Hays Code, which did establish new restrictions on the kind of content that could be featured in Hollywood films. Babyface is an incredibly frank depiction of a woman who tires of being exploited for her body and her sexuality and decides to turn the tables and use that sexuality to acquire money, power, and status.
The original cut of Babyface only saw a limited release before being pulled from theaters and re-edited to remove some of the more explicit scenes. I don't know if we can really say explicit. Let's call them very suggestive, Josh, for 1933, as well as tacking on an ending that shows Stanwyck's Lily powers not just redeemed, but punished. In 2004, mercifully, a print of the original cut was discovered, and that is the film that is in widest circulation today, the one that's on most streaming platforms, and the one that you can see on Turner Classic Movies. It's also the version we're going to talk about today.
So if you look at Stanwyck's career a little earlier than this, it began at the dawn of the talkie era. So by 1933, by the time of Babyface, she'd already appeared and starred in, actually, several films, including titles directed by the likes of Frank Capra and William Wellman. But we start with Babyface. This introduces us to Stanwyck and to pre-code Hollywood. We meet her character, Lily Powers, as a young woman working at her abusive father's Pittsburgh speakeasy. The film suggests that her father has been pimping her out for money and political favors, possibly since she was as young as 14. He dies in a whiskey still explosion. One thing we might
talk
about.
Could happen to anybody.
Well, I'd like to see how much of that is an accident. I think that's in play. It might not be. We can maybe talk about that. Afterwards, Lily escapes to New York with her father's black servant, Chico, played by Teresa Harris. Soon, she's sleeping her way to the top of the Gotham Trust Bank, something literalized in a shot I want to talk about in this movie. Things do take a nasty turn when one of her lovers shoots and kills another lover and then kills himself. And yeah, maybe not explicit, Adam, but it's all pretty much there on the screen in this pre-code effort. So I'm not sure how much familiarity you have with pre-code content. Adam, I know you have some familiarity with Stanwyck, more than I do. Is this the earliest Stanwyck effort that you've seen? And I'd be curious to know how this version of her sat aside, maybe the more even fully formed one that you're already familiar with.
This is my earliest Stanwyck. And in terms of, I'll say here up front, my exposure to pre-code Hollywood films, it probably would have been a more appropriate marathon subject for us, or at least for me, because usually we're trying to launch into a series of films that fill cinematic blind spots. And I've seen three of the six Stanwyck movies we're going to talk about, including the one we're going to talk about next week, 1937's Stella Dallas. But I think this is my first pre-code Hollywood film. Now, we're going to end with Double Indemnity. At least that's what the lineup has right now. And I certainly think you see a lot of the same ruthlessness, gumption, lack of sentimentality, ease with seduction that you get in that film on display right away, as far back as 1933. And we've touched on this already a couple times, but this movie's reputation is for being so salacious. And yes, it had to be edited and it was re-released. And you're watching it with a modern eye and a little bit scoffing at that fact. But then you do realize that even back in the 30s, seeing something as suggestive as that moment when she first decides to use her new superpower, the realization that she can basically get whatever she wants if she just turns it on with a man, it's on the train when they're leaving town and they're going to go off to the city, and she's brought Chico with her. And that moment where Chico just starts singing the tune and goes to another side of the train car, and I think the man who's about to kick them off sits down, and doesn't he take his hat off or something like that? We see the hat, and then we just see the fade, and that's all we see. And yet it is so clear what is happening there in that instance. And Josh, that qualified apparently as being quite scandalous back in the 30s.
I think it's still scandalous. I mean, we all sat up and took notice. I don't, I'll put it this way, watching it together as a family, I don't think we were prepared for a moment like that in a film this old. Obviously, if it had shown up in a contemporary movie, it would have just washed right by us probably. But I think everyone kind of sat up a little bit and was like, whoa, this is really going for it. There's another touch in that scene, Adam. And the director, I don't think we've mentioned here yet, is Alfred E. Green. A close-up that we get just before the details you're describing that is so crucial in how this movie documents the transfer of power, that security guard grabs Chico by the arm, and we get a close-up of his hand on her arm, and then we either hear Stanwyck, we hear Lily, or maybe there's a cut back to her as she says something, I forget, basically making it clear, making the invitation, and then we see the close-up where his hand lets go and moves away from Chico. He moves towards Lily, and it absolutely suggests this transfer of power in that moment, but also from man to woman, from quote unquote criminals to the other way, I'm sorry, from the law in this situation to criminals. And I thought that was such a key visual detail of just the man letting go and thinking this is going to be the pattern, right? He's letting go of one thing to get another thing, thinking that he's still going to be in power or get what he wants, not knowing that it's going to be his downfall. Now, we don't see what happens to this particular security guard, but certainly the other men, it becomes a pattern where they are far worse off after having met Lily, even though they're the ones who made the choice to follow her. I think, you know, you said salacious, and it's maybe not as salacious in its explicit imagery, but I think this movie is salacious in its attitude. And that is to say, in Stanwyck's attitude. And I want to be very careful how I say this here, because I don't mean this dismissively. And I'm eager to see how this might expand as we move further into her career. but she is very much playing an attitude first in this movie, more than I would say a character. Some of that is maybe in the script. Certainly, this is a character who goes on a journey, and I'm not saying this to diminish Stanwyck's capabilities as an actor, but it is attitude first, and that is part of what makes this so fun. It's a salacious attitude. It's a physical attitude. The way she stands and sits is so dismissive of just about everyone else around her. The blunt line delivery she gives to all of these great one-liners that she has is also pure attitude. And what all of that does, or at least did for me, is it made her rise seem inevitable. Like there is nothing that is going to stop her once she has decided to move ahead in this way. And you can see it just in the way she fills a room. You get the sense that whoever comes into that room, whatever Lily wants to be the outcome of this encounter is going to happen. And somehow Stanwyck communicates this just in the way she's kind of sitting in a chair, not bothered about what could happen because she knows what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And she's easily going to make it happen.
What part of the South are you from, Mr. Pratt?
Tallapoosa, Georgia.
I know some Pratts where I come from.
Where was that?
Oh, maybe I'll tell you someday when I know you better. Say, I like it here. How about a job?
Well, we don't...
Oh, now, don't tell me in this great big building there ain't someplace for me.
Have you had any experience?
Plenty.
You mentioned some of the visual details here, and one I loved early on when we're being introduced to her and her circumstances is when she goes to the window and she actually has to blow the dirt off of the flowers that are right outside the window. Of course, it's black and white, but you can tell that these are really grungy, grimy, not well manicured flowers. And it's a lovely bit of character and world building in that it tells you all you need to know about the type of men who would be in this establishment, the type of upbringing she's had, the fact that this is this really grimy factory town, but it also suggests that she has an appreciation for, or at least she's able to acknowledge beauty or the potential of beauty. And you wonder, of course, if there's a bit of a metaphor there in her as the flower who eventually is going to blow all that dirt and grime off. And we're going to see her in these incredible outfits.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was going to say. Think of the transformations that she makes in terms of, yeah, the costume design, but also the hair design, how each, it's almost as if with each man comes another manifestation of Lily, of who she can envision herself to be. So
totally.
Yeah, I do like that callback to the flower. And I have to ask, did it cross your mind? I don't think sincerely that she somehow arranged for the explosion to basically knock off her own father. But in the moment, and knowing how she had already, the ruthlessness, we'd already seen her.
Right.
I did wonder. I had to pause and say, was that an accident?
Well, she hadn't actually really thoroughly studied the Nietzsche.
That's
yet,
right.
So
yes, that's...
I don't think she was capable of that, Josh. I actually had another thought that I don't think is supposed to be borne out by the movie at all. But the argument between father and daughter that precedes that and the event that precedes that is that politician who comes in and tries to have his way with her, and she hits him with a beer bottle and he leaves, and the father says, oh, that's going to be the ruin of me. He basically lets me get away with this establishment. I almost wondered actually if that was the punishment, if that politician somehow arranged for the place to blow up. I don't think that's the case. I think it's either bad luck or good luck, depending on how you look at it. Certainly Lily looks at it more in terms of the latter. But I joke about Nietzsche, and there was a part of me that I suppose was a little bit disappointed early on to find that it wasn't an epiphany she had about her superpower, and that she's going to turn the tables and she's going to exploit herself and she's going to use men, that it took another man to tell her that that was something she could do. At the same time, I think that really does make sense for for the film and the time period that no matter how strong-willed she is, and no matter how much of an individual she is, there is something about the patriarchy and its oppressiveness and the power dynamics between genders at the time that it's completely inconceivable even to Lily that she could do that, that she would be capable of that. But once the idea is planted, she goes with it.
A woman young, beautiful like you can get anything she wants in the world because you have power over men. But you must use men, not let them use you. You must be a master, not a slave. Look, here, Nietzsche says, all life, no matter how we idealize it, is nothing more nor less than exploitation. That's what I'm telling you. Exploit yourself. Go to some big city where you will find opportunities. Use men. Be strong, defiant. Use men to get the things you want.
Alphonse Ethier, I think is how you pronounce it, plays the cobbler who introduces her to Nietzsche. Good question. I think that would probably undercut things more for me if we had not already had Lily established as someone with that capability, with that determination, force of will, going back to that politician before she cracks the bottle over his head, which is just an incredible moment. Think of how she responds to him when he comes into this speakeasy and says something to her, how are you doing or how have you been? And right, just without half a second in between that, she just says, I was good up till now. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, instantaneously putting him down and telling him she's having none of it. So I think it's the combination of the superpower was there. And it's like, you know, put this in Spider-Man terms. It took the cobbler handing her that book. That's when the spider bit her, you know, and that kind of like ignites everything. So, that's a good question. I think she was always capable of this.
Yeah, I like a phrase you used earlier when you talk about whoever she envisions herself to be. And one of my favorite shots in the movie is that reflection, the mirror shot we get early on at the bank when she's been caught with the first man of authority. And it's Mr. Stevens who comes in and he fires that guy. And we see him looking at her, but we see her first through the mirror looking at the mirror, and it seems as though she's looking at him. And then as she walks closer, we see her actually emerge into frame, and that is that reflection shot. And that's where it really clicked for me that what she is doing every time we see her with a man, when she needs to get what she wants, she puts on whatever face, whatever attitude, whatever demeanor they need her to be. And they are willing to go along with any version of herself that most makes them feel good as a man, basically. The kind of man they want to be, that's who she puts on the persona of. And I do want to go back real quick and say that you're usually the one who spends time on the costuming in a film. And I don't have any real insights to add. I just know that at some point, and I know exactly what point it was, it's when she's in the car on the rainy day in Paris with Trenum, and she's wearing this black dress with like this white V, and her hair is incredible. And I had to acknowledge it in my notes. Meanwhile, Sophie's watching it with me, and Sophie goes, everything she wears in this movie just slays. And I go, yeah, that's literally exactly what I just wrote in my notes. Well, maybe not literally. I wrote costumes. I don't quite articulate it
costumes,
the way.
Costumes. I like.
Yeah. I like. Yeah, I didn't quite go slays, but they are insane. And I think if you really did go back to each one of those scenes, you see that. You see that sense of her playing that role for whatever man she needs to.
Yeah, and it's an elevation in elegance, I think, with each transformation as she is rising in society, or at least rising in wealth, let's say that. Maybe not in society. You know, we don't get the sense that she ever has any sort of social cachet. She's kind of alone with, you know, the Teresa Harris character in these mansions that she, these high-rise penthouses. But yeah, she is definitely rising in terms of wealth. With you on the black gown, gonna have to say I did not care for the ones. It must have been a thing at the time where a bow tie was somehow incorporated in the dresses. Those just threw me off a little bit. A little strange, but that's probably a personal taste thing. But absolutely, costuming is so crucial to the character development here. And as far as, you know, her rising, the shot I referenced as we were setting this up, how about the camera, the outside miniature shot of this bank skyscraper? That's how we're communicating her quote-unquote promotions.
Her ascension. The climb up the ladder. Yeah.
The camera just floats from one window to the next. Conveniently, the department, the name of the department, hand lettered on the exterior of the window, even though you're like 40 floors up. I don't know why they're bothering, right, but it helps us as the audience. And I thought that was, you know, there's not a ton of humor here except for the biting humor that Stanwyck has. And I did think that camera movement, which is a recurring thing, was a nice little sort of a wink, you know, and maybe even a way, even pre-code, to get around showing us what's actually going on in the bedroom.
Yeah. Another element I appreciated about this film, and I'm going to use a word here that's pretty loaded right now, and it has to do with the position that she puts all of these men in. And it's not just that they maybe are willing to, or they have to feel like they have to compromise their morals or their ideals and beliefs. And it's not just that she's using them, but she puts all of these men in a position where they have to make a difficult choice. And where it really occurred to me is the one with Mr. Parker, I think is his name, right? Fuzzy Wuzzy, as she calls him. And she puts on that kind of damsel in distress, or at least the innocent woman routine, as if she was in love with the man who's supposed to be his future son-in-law, and this is her first, and he buys all of it. Actually, it might even be earlier, now that I think about it. It might actually be Stevens who, when she puts on that innocent routine, he says, "I'll have to think this over." And as we saw early in the film, she is always the one who's put in a position where she has to make a decision that she doesn't want to make. She's either going to slap that politician and not sleep with him, or there's going to be consequences for it. There's always some ramification to her choice. And the table that she really turns on these men is always putting them in a position where they've got to make the uncomfortable choice that might actually ruin their lives.
And I think that's so crucial. And another thing that Stanwyck brings to the performance, this difficult choice idea, because otherwise, if she's purely overpowering them, where they have no choice, where she just walks into the room and they lose all control of their faculties, that's not what's going on. They are absolutely attracted. But the trick, if you want to call it that, or what makes the movie more sophisticated than it might at first seem to be, is that they ultimately do decide to step forward. They have a chance to go the other direction and instead step right into it. And now you can say, well, we're just playing semantics here. Like, isn't she laying that trap out? And the end is always going to be the same. But no, I think it is more subtle and nuanced than that. At the same time, she has such calculation and such cruelty, really. You could also characterize this as a revenge flick, as everything she does. Yes, I think we're meant to understand she's mostly motivated by wealth and security, two things she did not have. And maybe even wealth is too strong of a word, but just financial security. Those are her motivations. But in her meanest moments, this almost did play like a feminist revenge flick. That is, she's getting back on any man who gets in front of her for what she endured when she was younger. And, you know, that I'm not saying that necessarily would have made it a lesser film. I think it would have made it a simpler one than what we do get here.
You do get that element, though, even in her dealings with Trenholm, where she is willing to go to Paris and take the bank job and not have any fun, not go out with any men, all, and maybe this is where the plot gets a little silly, all so she can eventually get the payoff of letting him know that he was wrong about her.
Yeah.
He may never even come over to that branch, but when he does, if he does, she's going to be ready and she's going to make him feel foolish by subverting his expectations for her.
Frankly, I am surprised.
Why?
I didn't expect you to stick to the job.
That's why I stuck.
One might imagine that you'd find this business life rather dull.
One might imagine that you know practically nothing about me.
Still, it would have been easy for you to come here to Paris and have a somewhat gayer time.
It would have been too easy. That's what you expected me to do.
She's in it for the long haul here.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
She's going to get what she thinks she deserves.
Or was it sort of a long game she was playing with him. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that.
Yeah.
I don't think that's really the case, but there's definitely that possibility. You just don't know with this character, which is, you know, part of the thrill of watching her go through her various manipulations.
Yeah. But does it, Josh, in your mind, does it ultimately deliver the way we want it to? And my question for you is the more difficult question, and that's why I'm posing it to you, is what do we even want ultimately from this film? And of course, that's a difficult question, or a different question to answer as men in 2022, as women in 2022, or going back and putting ourselves in the shoes of a viewer of the time. There just comes a point in the film where you know that for its aggressiveness in terms of its lack of sentimentality, for its suggestiveness that does cross over into perhaps salaciousness, is it going to be even a pre-code film? Is it going to be ultimately a movie that needs to give us some kind of more conventional payoff or a more conventional punishment? And she has to pay for her sins in some way. And at some point in the film, as we see that turn it takes with Trenholm, I was asking myself, and I didn't really come up with the answer, what do I want for her character? Do I want her to find happiness, whatever that seems to be? Do I want her to be the woman the movie gives us or seems to give us at the end of the film, who has come to terms with this relationship and maybe has given up on this life of revenge and seduction and exploiting men? Or damn it, do I want the movie to live up to the ideals of the man who says use men, and she deserves to get everything that's coming to her because of the way she's treated? I do think at some point it becomes clear, taking out the alternate ending, which I haven't seen, taking that out of the equation, I still think the movie probably tries to have it both ways and doesn't quite pull that off.
Well, yeah, the censored ending, if you want to call that, the reshot ending is definitely, from what I understand, the punishment one. Mm-hmm. And I actually was quite impressed with the one we get here, which is essentially the originally shot ending. So what do we want? I think in my mind, what you're hoping for, and this comes again from those early scenes, whereas, you know, hard-bitten of a character as she already is, they're living with her father, you recognize she's been through intense trauma. And so I think what you want for her is healing. And I think you recognize that even as there is a thrill in the ways we've been talking to see her get revenge on some of these men, take advantage of these men who are otherwise going to take advantage of her, and attain some wealth, attain some security, you do get a sense that this is not going to provide her healing. This is not going to provide her wholeness. And there was a little scene that accentuated this. We haven't talked much about the Teresa Harris character, Chico.
Yeah, so meet her. I did want to get into that.
Yeah, we meet her early on, a servant for Lily's father. And as we've mentioned, when Lily flees, Chico comes with. I thought that was fascinating that they were going to carry her through the rest of the film, and she essentially becomes Lily's servant. Yet they have this interesting dynamic where, yeah, Lily tells her what to do, but it is very much in a friendship demeanor for much of the movie. And you think
there isn't a power imbalance.
There doesn't seem to be a power imbalance. No. It almost seems like, in the way I read it, was the way our friendship is going to survive in this society, in this day and age, is you play the part of my maid or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll play the part of the woman. And
you
they've
look
created
the other way when you need to.
You look
you
the other
walk
way
to the other side of the train car. And
they've
we'll
created
be okay.
this very comfortable life for each other by Lily doing this to these men and continuing to rise. So that was fascinating to me. But you do notice that it's still eating Lily away inside because later there is a scene where she gets very agitated and her attitude towards Chico changes and she snaps at her and starts commanding her in the way that an affluent white society woman would dismissively do to a black employee. And I noticed that scene and it's just kind of emphasized for me that she hasn't healed all that much. She's not any more whole. She's more secure, but she's not any more whole. So I really like where we get with the George Brent character, who is the banker, who suddenly the bank collapses. He's desperate, needs money. I think needs more than the money he's given her. The implications are he needs some of the money she's earned earlier, right? And
possibly
to help him out. And so now she does have to choose. It's for one thing, it allows Stanwyck to move beyond the attitude because she has that sequence where she tells him, she breaks down. I can't do it. I've got to think of myself. She's hitting different notes there than she does anywhere else in the movie.
That's true.
And the other interesting thing is now the power clearly in Lily's hands, even with this guy, her biggest target. But we also know she genuinely cares for him. And so the movie leaves us with this question of what's she going to do now that she does hold ultimate power? What is she going to choose? And I think the answer to that choice is for her a step towards the healing that I would like to see from her. I think the movie threads the needle pretty well on that count. But what did you think?
Well, I think that despite Stanwyck's ability to hit any note she wants, and I agree that that scene is really wonderful because you see the conflict come through. You see how it is torturing her to potentially leave him behind and at the same time think about herself, which she has trained herself to do. She reads that line, crush all sentimentality, and there she is being overwhelmed by it and pushing back on it. And it's really a wonderful scene and does truly showcase how great of an actress Stanwyck is. I'll also mention that, yes, she maybe cons him a little bit with the whole I really want to have a missus on my tombstone thing, but otherwise he's the one man that even with that little charade with the taxi to get in his car, it doesn't feel as overt in terms of her trying to work him the way she does the
I'd agree.
Other men. So there's more of an equality between the two of them that then justifies where the movie ends up. And yet, maybe this is me with a 2022 perspective wanting her to just really bring the hellfire, bring the vengeance, and just torture everybody. And the fact that the movie does end on a sentimental note, even if Stanwyck can deliver it, watching her have to turn in to that more loving, caring person, it was a little bit tougher, I think, than it was for you, Josh. And it really just comes down to the way I was buying into her treatment by this society and the progressivism of the politics to push it as far as it does. And I was going to say, that's another element I really like. You mentioned the Chico character. It's notable that early on, the father abusing her verbally even more than he abuses his daughter and is about ready to fire her. And she uses whatever leverage she has, Lily does, to make sure she stays on the job. And then, of course, brings her with her. They both go to the city together. And that moment you mentioned on the train, it's notable, too, that that guy may say, okay, you guys are coming off the train with me. And he probably does intend to get rid of both of them. But whose arm does he grab first?
Yeah.
You know, he grabs the black woman in that case. And yes, Lily is standing up for herself, but she's standing up for Chico again in that moment as well. Totally random. I did have to laugh a little bit when Stanwyck makes a joke about being a real ball of fire. She says, of course, we're going to watch a film called Ball of Fire later. I don't know, probably fairly common. And I don't know that Hawks chose to call his movie that because of that line. But then Did you notice, am I crazy, I couldn't find the credit, Josh. That police officer outside the bank.
Oh, he's in the cameraman.
He's in the cameraman,
right? It's
got
to be him. We said the same thing.
It's got to be him. Yeah, it's got to be him. He was so recognizable.
Or this guy's ripping that guy off pretty badly.
Yeah, yeah. And early on, especially in that first scene after she turns it on and plays really nice and charming with him, he starts to make a lot of silent film kind of faces just to make sure the audience understands that he's feeling a certain way about her. So I had to throw that out there and make sure I wasn't crazy.
Let me look up the cop credited in the cameraman right now, Harry Gribben. Let's see if he's credit here. And he's in Babyface Doorman. That's him.
Yeah, that's him. That is absolutely him. So good pull. You remembered him from the cameraman. And indeed, I'm not crazy. Next up in our Barbara Stanwyck marathon, it is 1937 Stella Dallas. That's available on YouTube and on Amazon Prime. I don't want to predispose you at all, Josh, but you are going to see throughout that toughness that Stanwyck always brings, certainly, but you're going to see the softer side. You're going to see a softer side in Stella Dallas.
Can't wait.
It'll balance things out nicely, I think. For the full Stanwyck marathon lineup and where to watch them, go to filmspotting.net/marathons.
Stanwyck, just one of the iconic stars of the 1930s. We highlight a few others with our 30s starter pack when we come back. Plus, a new film spotting poll asking you to name your favorite Jane Austen adaptation. Stay with us.
I did that intentionally.
Well, if I could think, I'd have run when I saw you.
No, but if you'd only wait while I explain, I'll just save you my pistol. Oh, you've torn your coat. Now, I didn't do it on purpose. It's not right. That's not right. It's not my fault. I didn't mean to do it. I just did it, but I didn't mean
Catherine Hepburn and Cary Grant in 1938's Bringing Up Baby. Last week, Josh, I was joking about my Baz Luhrmann allergy, my other movie-related allergy. It's to Bringing Up Baby.
Like you're negative on it is what you're saying.
Yeah, we had an early film spotting marathon devoted to comedies, devoted to screwball comedies, and it was a blind spot for both producer Sam and I. And of course, it being Hawks as well, I firmly expected to adore every aspect of this film. Who doesn't love Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn? And I think I equated the experience to basically sitting right next to a pep band at a basketball game that's just blaring at you for 80 minutes or 100 minutes. I probably would have a different reaction to it now, but that was an early classic film that I did not go for the way most people have gone for it throughout the history of cinema. And in this case, I had Sam on my side. So, you know, both of us are wrong.
Maybe you just hadn't adjusted yet to the volume and rhythm and speed.
That's it.
Of the genre.
Yeah. We played that clip from Bringing Up Baby because a couple of weeks ago we were getting in a 30s movies kind of mood, anticipating our Barbara Stanwyck marathon, and we asked you this poll question. What is your favorite 1930s film starring an iconic actor-actress duo? So yes, as you will hear our listeners pontificate, some of them here in a moment, you could emphasize the actor-actress duo. That could really drive your choice, but we are asking, what is your favorite 1930s film starring one of those duos? The options we gave you were The Adventures of Robin Hood, that's Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland, or you could go Hepburn and Grant and Bringing Up Baby, Gable and Lee, Gone with the Wind, Gable Again with Claudette Colbert in It Happened One Night, William Powell and Myrna Loy, The Thin Man, or Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire in Top Hat. Finally, if you didn't like our choices, you could go other. We did get some accusations of yet another film spotting, deeply flawed poll question, but I look at the results and see other with only 1%. Sam must have done okay with his choices.
Yeah, that's usually a good sign. Second to last place was Gone with the Wind with 6%. Top Hat got 8%. And The Adventures of Robin Hood received 10%. Jumping up a little bit here, we had It Happened One Night with 20% of the vote. The Thin Man, 26% of the vote. But Adam, yes, Bringing Up Baby. Listeners loved it, or at least they loved the pairing of Hepburn and Grant because it won the poll with 28% of the vote.
Yeah, though I love this first comment we have from Kevin White, because at first I thought it was a setup for explaining why he went in a different direction. And it helps in terms of making my case for the reaction I had the lone time I've watched this film. But no, it is in fact evidence being entered for why Kevin thinks it's the right choice in this poll. He says, a great set of choices, but I have to push for Hepburn and Grant in Bringing Up Baby. They're both so obnoxious that it's evident over the course of the often frustrating and repetitive film that these two ridiculous caricatures deserve each other.
So a little backhanded praise, I guess, from Kevin. We also heard from Kyle. Bringing Up Baby invites us to laugh at an unfunny movie about a legit insane person.
Okay.
Cheat a little and add Philadelphia Story to the mix, and I'd vote for that Hepburn-Grant pairing, which is perfectly Yar? Perfectly Yar? Can you help me with that, Adam?
Well, I fortunately have a note here from our intrepid producer, Sam, that says Yar or Yer, or Yar with an E, is a nautical term that means ready or prepared for action, quick to move. We are 100% positive that the only person since maybe the 1930s who has used that word is Michael Phillips.
Maybe that's where Kyle got it from.
Indeed.
Jeremy L. also weighed in. As a major Grant Hepburn fan, I propose Holiday from 1938 instead of Bringing Up Baby. I've always been a bit wearied by the rapid-fire pacing and dialogue of some of the films in the screwball canon, like It Happened One Night and His Girl Friday. By contrast, I find that Holiday contains a refreshing dose of melancholy and genuine dramatic tension that I felt has been lacking from its frothier relatives. Now, Adam, you know I would love to just let you hang out to dry on this Bringing Up Baby thing. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, though I do like it, I am cooler on it than something like Holiday.
Are you?
I am. I do like Holiday a bit better. So I'm with Jeremy on this one.
Well, now I know that my first reaction was wrong and I have to watch Bringing Up Baby again. And, you know, speaking of Michael Phillips, Jeremy, not so big on His Girl Friday, it sounds, which means that Michael would not call Jeremy a pip. Leslie Lewis says, it has to be Nick and Nora in The Thin Man. Watched these movies as a kid on 1950s TV. Loved the snappy adult banter. Plus, they made booze look really cool. At one point in my childhood, I wanted to grow up to be a bartender. Did not achieve my goal, which was for the best.
Another vote for Powell and Loy here from Nancy W. They've embodied my couple goals since I first saw the movie as a teenager. Witty banter, equality in drinking, playfulness, and lots of love.
Yeah, well said. Joel says, though, It Happened One Night is funnier, more romantic, and simply better than Bringing Up Baby. If you're voting for Baby due to Grant and Hepburn being hotter, though, then fine.
Okay, here's Alan N. My favorite film of this bunch is Robin Hood. But I've never thought of this film because of the actor-actress duo. I think of Flynn, Raines, and Rathbone before I think of de Havilland. So I went with Loy and Powell and The Thin Man.
Well, our resident Adventures of Robin Hood expert, who truly does love this movie more than maybe Michael Curtiz did, Sam Van Halgren, he says that Alan must be watching the movie incorrectly. Because yes, the ensemble's great, but how does this movie work without the chemistry of Robin and de Havilland's Marion? He's got a point.
I mean, unfortunately, I've only seen this movie probably two or three times many years ago. Love Adventures of Robin Hood, but I'm a bit with Alan that I do not remember many of the de Havilland scenes. Mm. Whereas the swashbuckling, the sword fighting, all that stuff, of course, I was much younger when I saw it. So maybe Sam's right, and a revisit, I would agree with him.
Aaron Bergstrom says, come on, people, Top Hat. In parentheses, or Swing Time.
Can't go wrong with either of those, Aaron. Last comment here is from Tom Morris. Went with Other, Modern Times, with Charlie Chaplin and Paulette Goddard.
Can't argue with that choice either, Josh. Great stuff, as always, from our listeners. Thank you for voting in that poll. That does mean it's time for a new poll question. And we are, once and for all, going to decide, or at least our listeners are, what the best Jane Austen film adaptation is. This is anticipating in a couple of weeks Austin's Persuasion coming to Netflix. Dakota Johnson stars in that.
And this reminds me, I should acknowledge, because this was one of my summer movie preview questions, right? Whether Persuasion will add fire to the great Jane Austen adaptation debate, which we're going to get into here. Someone emailed in, I can't remember her name, I apologize, but pointing out that I hadn't mentioned a television adaptation of Persuasion. I think it came out in 1995 as something that had previously been done. I was keeping my list that I mentioned to feature releases. So just throwing out that out there, because I do know we did get that email. So I wanted to acknowledge that we saw that.
Yeah. And that's a good transition, Josh, because we are not including any TV adaptations, no BBC work in this poll question. It is strictly film. And yes, I know that may for some mean that this poll is in fact flawed, like you would expect it to be. So the options we're giving you are
Amy Heckerling's Clueless, that was out in 95, an adaptation of Austin's Emma. Then we have 2020's Emma, that one from director Autumn DeWilde. It starred Anya Taylor-Joy. Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship came out in 2016. This one, probably going to be the leader, I would think. Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley from 2005. We also have Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility from 95. That one starred Emma Thompson and Kate Winslet. And if you do want to go in the other option, maybe you prefer 96's Emma with Gwyneth Paltrow or 1999's Mansfield Park, or perhaps you want to go all the way back to 1940's Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, and we're not too strict here. If you really wanted to push for Bridget Jones's Diary, which is loosely considered an Austen adaptation, again, we're not going to fight with you. But do you have a clear winner in this poll, Josh?
So I like all of these. Big fan of all of these films. If you go by star ratings, I think I have Love and Friendship as the highest rated adaptation. Now, I never wrote about or have rated or ranked officially Clueless. And in my mind, that one is right up there with it. So for me, it's probably between one of those two. Though again, big fan of all the options here.
Yeah, I think Clueless probably has a shot. I don't think it's going to win the poll, but it will be second or third. And I don't imagine Love and Friendship is going to have much of a chance at all. I think that little scene film from Whit Stillman's probably going to finish near the bottom with Other, but that's kind of where I'm leaning right now as well. I do have one big caveat here, however, which is inexplicably, I've still never seen Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility. And at the time, it was a very acclaimed, well-talked about film. Loved Emma Thompson, still love Emma Thompson, but I really liked her in the 90s as I was discovering Kenneth Branagh and, of course, the Shakespeare films with Emma, then his wife. Kate Winslet, great actress. Ang Lee. There's no reason why I shouldn't have seen this film, and yet I didn't, and I still haven't. So that makes my vote even more inconsequential than it normally would be, Josh.
But for now, it's Love and Friendship, you think you would go?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It's the one I enjoyed the most of the ones otherwise listed. But I do like Clueless, as I mentioned. I do really like the 2020 Emma. And Pride and Prejudice, I think I gave it 3 stars. I think we've acknowledged that I'm not in the 5-star range. And my daughter, Sophie, there somehow still lives with me, because this is straight 5-star, watched it a million times, kind of masterpiece for her. But I did like it. So you really can't go wrong with this one, Josh.
Well, and I would just encourage people, if they haven't, check out Love and Friendship, though. Kate Beckinsale, just surprisingly, it maybe sounds bad, but I remember just being a bit of a revelation in how good she's in that. So you're right. It is underseen. And maybe this is a good excuse for some folks to become Austen adaptation completists and check that one off their list.
You can vote in that poll now and leave a comment at filmspotting.net.
This week on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, I don't know, Adam, you're probably not going to want to partake given your Baz Luhrmann allergy. Take your pills beforehand, perhaps, but they are looking at Elvis and pairing it. Oh, two Bazes with the 2001 Best Picture nominated Moulin Rouge. Cannot wait to hear this one.
I do have a question about this, and this isn't me trying to dial it back at all, Josh. I really am just asking for your take, because we've done this show long enough now. I will always embrace the shtick. Whatever people want to believe, I'll lean into it. I'll play up the Baz Luhrmann allergy for as long as we're doing this show. But last weekend when we were setting up Elvis, or setting up your take on it, I did start to do the math in my head a little bit, and I wanted to check the receipts. And I realized that before Elvis, Baz Luhrmann has, I think, only made 5 feature films. Of those 5, I haven't seen 2 of them. Of the 3 I've seen, it is true, I did not like Australia much. 2 out of 5 stars. It's also true, I didn't like The Great Gatsby much. I checked Letterboxd, only gave it 2 stars. But I didn't hate The Great Gatsby, I just was negative on it. And I really like Moulin Rouge. So, did those 2 out of 3 negative reviews actually make me someone who's allergic to Baz Luhrmann? Or should I have not brought this up and
Adam,
just kept playing up the shtick?
Adam, do you want to come on the Baz Luhrmann bandwagon? I've got a seat here.
I don't know if I'm ready for
that. I've got a seat here. I've sort of been saving it for you. I would love to welcome you aboard. All past grievances will be forgotten.
Wow.
You will be required to revisit those films you've dismissed unnecessarily and come to appreciate them, but maybe we can do that on the bus together.
Come on, Josh. If I go to LarsonOnFilm.com, I am not going to find a positive review of Australia.
You want me to do the ranking? You want me to do the Baz Luhrmann ranking?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So I'm going to say Moulin Rouge at the top, then Romeo and Juliet, then Australia.
Oh, come on.
And then Elvis. The problem with Elvis is, like, Elvis's highs are higher than Australia's highs, but its lows are lower. So there's a wide variation with Elvis. But still, again, overall positive. Uh-huh. My Baz Luhrmann apology is that his breakout, his debut, Strictly Ballroom, still unseen by me.
It's one of mine, too.
My fear is that it's probably a little too tame. Like, he hadn't really come into his own and just, like,
I might appreciate it.
Spewed everything possible on the screen, as he tends to do now. Yeah, that might be your favorite. So, yeah, come on aboard, Adam.
Okay.
We'll cure your allergy.
The Next Picture Show is hosted by Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Stella, I can't have our child living this way.
What's wrong this time?
It's not just this time. It's every time
What do you mean? Because there was a couple of drinks? Well, what's wrong with that? Coming in here with that icebergy way of yours.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude. But she's my child, too, and I won't have this. I haven't wanted to take Laurel away from you, but if you...
Take her away from me?
That's Barbara Stanwyck in 1937 Stella Dallas. That's next up in our Summer of Stanwyck marathon. We were hoping to get to an early screen of Thor, Love and Thunder. I still haven't broken this to Debbie, Adam. I think at one point I promised her I'll get you into that press screening, and that's not going to go over well. But we're going to review it. Rather than doing that next week's show, we'll do it the week after it opens, and we'll return to our Stanwyck marathon with Dallas, which did earn Stanwyck her first Oscar nomination.
That film also as good a place as any to segue into a revisit of our 1930s starter pack. This is basically our top 5 movies from the 1930s, or at least it started out that way, but different from other top 5s. We really were making the list for listeners who maybe haven't seen a lot of films from that era, and we wanted to offer a diverse list of titles, some comedy, some action, some drama, some musicals. Stella Dallas didn't make my top 5, but it did get an honorable mention. And as I mentioned earlier, we did this top 5 in early 2020, just before setting out on a marathon devoted to another queen of classic cinema, Bette Davis. When we look at the titles we put on this list, I feel good about my choices, Josh, but I'm actually a little bit embarrassed by where this list fell in terms of us not having gotten to Bette Davis yet. And something like Jezebel from 1938, had we done this list later, that would have been in strong contention. And even before, just before this top 5, we did our Dietrich von Sternberg marathon, and somehow I didn't consider strongly enough, apparently, Shanghai Express for my list.
I did have Shanghai Express as an honorable mention, but yeah, didn't quite crack that top five, the starter pack, which, as you said, for me as well, wanted to be a sampling of the prominent genres and the highlights of that decade. I'm with you, though. I think Bette Davis in Jezebel, that might have been from 38, might have had a chance to crack it. I think it was both our shared favorite picture of that Davis marathon. Mm-hmm. And another one that I've seen since wouldn't have made the top five, but I think is also interesting in the light of our Stanwyck marathon. We've been on a, you know, years long on and off again family Joan Crawford marathon. And in that time since we did the starter pack, I've seen Possessed from 31, stars Clark Gable, interesting, talking about iconic on-screen duos, and fascinatingly similar narrative to Babyface. Crawford plays a young woman who leaves her life behind in a dismal small town to start over in New York City and uses all of the tools at her disposal at that time to do that. So very interesting, just what, a few years earlier, to have a similar narrative. And actually, Crawford and Stanwyck are going to be a point of comparison for me, not just because I've been seeing a lot of Crawford movies, but I looked up in David Thompson's new biographical dictionary of film. Always like to do this when we embark on a marathon about an actor or a filmmaker, just to see what he wrote about Stanwyck. Actually says he thinks Stanwyck is the greater actor between the two of them, of these, you know, icons. So, mm-hmm. Which is, for me, that got me so excited about delving into this marathon. And then again, thinking about Possessed from 31, how they both early in their careers played very similar parts. So Possessed, yeah, is one to keep in mind.
Well, this decade is so rich that even in the honorable mentions, we didn't get to some titles like Frank Capra's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. How about John Ford's biopic, Young Mr. Lincoln? We didn't include Stagecoach, Josh, on this top five, which absolutely could be part of any really good and compelling 1930s starter pack. The Rules of the Game from Renoir did make your list, didn't quite make mine, and I'll reconfess to the title that is maybe and has been for as long as I can remember my single biggest embarrassment in terms of cinematic blind spots. It's actually Renoir's Grand Illusion. Should have done my penance, Josh, before replaying this top five and finally watched that film. That said, we've seen a fair number of really good films from the 1930s. So from May 2020, here is our 1930s starter pack. And we start with a clip from the sole film that's in the film spotting pantheon from that decade.
Well, she seems all right now.
Yeah, she got quite a bump on the head. We kind of thought there for a minute she was going to leave us.
Oh. But I did leave you, Uncle Henry. That's just the trouble. And I tried to get back for days and days.
There, lie quiet now. You just had a bad dream.
Sure. You could do a top five list of the 30s that's just from 39. There are at least five masterpieces, including The Wizard of Oz, and maybe one or two others that will come up between our lists. So how did you approach this list?
So, yeah, having The Wizard of Oz in the pantheon definitely helped, because that is one that's in my top 20 of all time. All right. So it was nice to be able to set that aside. I also set it aside because as we're talking about this, we wanted to capture trends, I think, or genres that were popular in the 30s that defined the decade. So, yeah, this is not a best of the decade list. And The Wizard of Oz is something of a one-of-a-kind film, I think. It doesn't really represent a trend that you did see at that time. Other one-of-a-kind films would be Gone with the Wind. I would sort of put it in that category. I mean, it's a romantic drama, has an epic sweep. Certainly, sure, there were some of those, but it has come to stand alone, I think.
Yeah, I get it. There's the musical quality, obviously, as well, but very different than some others we may talk about.
Yep, I think so. And maybe something like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, a landmark film, absolutely, as Disney's first animated feature from 37, but also not quite representative of the decade. Now, I will say that, to go back and speak to your point about how great this decade was, I mentioned the top 20 of all time. We did that Sight and Sound list back in 2012 with Michael Phillips. Four titles in my top 20 came from the 1930s.
Really?
So three of them are going to be in my starter pack. I'm not going to spoil them here. I'll get to them as we proceed down the list.
I don't know that I had any from the 1930s. You are so much more sophisticated than I am, Josh. And actually, I joke because I thought about that to an extent, putting together my list. I wasn't just trying to pick the five films that I loved the most, but I did want there to be an element of fun to them. I wanted these to be films that potentially people could hear us and think, I do have a little bit of extra time and I haven't seen these movies. I'm going to watch it, want to give them a good time as they watch. But also there has to be that element of culture. There has to be that sense that you are watching five films from the decade that really stand out as five of the best and five films that every cinephile, frankly, probably does need to see. So I was trying to have that balance to my list. What's your number five? It doesn't really matter probably so much the order, though I did kind of count down in terms of my favorites.
Yeah, I think that's how I ranked these as well. Personal preference, but you couldn't go wrong starting with any of them on my list. Number five is The Public Enemy from 1931. So the gangster genre, I don't think you could say it was born in the 1930s. There are plenty of films like that from the silent era, but it probably came into its own during the decade with the advent of sound and then really the emergence of Warner Brothers as the genre's main producer. The stable that came from Warner Brothers included The Public Enemy, directed by William Wellman and starring James Cagney. He plays Tom Powers, who rises from an abusive childhood to small-time crime to big bootlegging as an adult. It's somewhat earlier films had these elements too, but you can look at this as the prototype really for almost every gangster movie ever made, both narratively and morally. This movie's treatment, again, 1931, of sex and violence is shockingly alive. It's definitely sensationalistic. At the same time, the movie makes sure that Tom gets what is coming to him in the end. So basically, Tom is going to pay the price for the audience's pleasure. And how many of our gangster films, crime films, really don't follow that same sort of arc? As Tom, Cagney is just mesmerizing. He's unpredictably frightening. He has these sleepy eyes, you know, and sort of an incongruous physical grace that relaxes you, and then the violence will erupt. One of his most famous scenes is in The Public Enemy. It's also a flashpoint for considering how this genre treats women. It's when he smashes a grapefruit into Mae Clark's face.
Yeah.
Ain't you got a drink in the house?
Well, not before breakfast, dear.
I didn't ask you for any lip. I asked you if you had a drink.
I know, Tom, but... Well, gee, I wish that...
There you go, that wishing stuff again. I wish you was a wishing well. So that I could tie a bucket to you and sink you.
That was some homework I had to do for this list. Have seen Angels with Dirty Faces, maybe one or two other Cagney films from the decade. But I think one of the pleasures for me, certainly the main pleasure, is watching Cagney and understanding that persona and how it has been so influential and been imitated so many times over the years. As someone who in the 80s loved, and frankly still love, the Michael Keaton comedy, Johnny Dangerously, I now understand almost all of the jokes that I didn't before. I mean, I knew what they were riffing on without knowing how much of it was sure. Coming directly from Cagney and The Public Enemy. There's also something about Cagney's face that struck me having watched Of Human Bondage first. But there's a similar quality between Davis and Cagney in terms of their face, something just literally about the structure of their face.
No, you're right. I can see
that. Where their lips are turned up a little bit and they've got that nose and they just always look like they're looking at you like,
yeah.
What's your problem?
Yeah, it's something, you know, to do with the eyes.
Yeah, there is something about their faces that is ready for whatever assault.
A challenge.
Yeah, might be coming their way or challenge. So I did appreciate that. I also loved, Josh, as you talk about the sensationalism of it, and this is pre-code here. With The Public Enemy, mm-hmm. pre-Hays Code, they still felt compelled to point out at the beginning and end that we're not doing this to try to be sensationalistic.
Yeah.
This isn't about having any pleasure as we watch these hoodlums. This is a problem.
There's a pre-apology.
Yeah, there's the pre-apology and at the end, a reminder mm-hmm. that this is an issue society is facing and you don't really believe a bit of the filmmakers at all as they tell you that, but I understand that they felt the need to, because otherwise it is really easy to watch Cagney and all those despicable things he's doing and think, I want to be kind of like mm-hmm. him.
Yeah, right? Looks like a lot of fun.
So I'm going to go to a 1939 film for my number five. It's one of two that is going to make my list. And this is, I think, one of the defining romantic comedies of the era. So many to choose from. I'm going with Ninotchka, starring Greta Garbo, Melvin Douglas, from director Ernst Lubitsch. This is a film that was part of our Ernst Lubitsch marathon, I think back in 2010 on the show, Josh. You're talking about one of the all-time master directors and, of course, one of the stars of the period, her period being the 20s and 30s. She only made one other film after Nadashka in 39. In 99, the American Film Institute did their top Hollywood stars, basically, of the classic Hollywood cinema, the top 25 actors, top 25 actresses, and Garbo was fifth on that list. You could probably guess the others, even if you got the order a little wrong. Katharine Hepburn, one. Betty Davis, two. Audrey Hepburn, three. Ingrid Bergman, four. Garbo, fifth. And I do think, like Davis, there's nobody else like Garbo. There's nobody else like Cagney. There's certainly nobody else like Garbo either. And this was her first time doing a full-on comedy where she plays a Russian diplomat who gets sent to Paris because some jewels that were seized during the Russian Revolution, these three guys that were sent have botched the sale of this, and she's got to go oversee it and make sure that everything ends up going smoothly. She meets Melvin Douglas's Count Leon, who is a capitalist to the core. He's all about indulging in the finer aspects of life and luxury, none of the things that she is into, of course, coming from Russia. And as you might expect, the opposites do end up attracting. She is playing this cold, humorless Russian, very stone face, but I think that only amplifies those wonderful comedic and romantic moments that we get in the film when you see those little breaks in the armor, basically. And its blend of dialogue, the repartee, and the physical comedy is another thing that really makes this film stand out, and something that Lubitsch was obviously a genius at. There's a key scene where she's drunk, Melvin Douglas is drunk, and she's talking about how happy she is. And of course, as a Russian coming from where she does, that must be too happy. Something must be wrong. She basically says, I should be stood up in front of a firing squad. That's how happy I am. I need to be punished for it.
Leon, I want to confess.
I know. It's a Russian soul.
Well, everyone wants to confess. And if they don't confess, they make them confess. I am a traitor. When I kissed you, I betrayed a Russian ideal. I should be stood up against the wall.
Will that make you any happier?
Much happier.
All right.
So the end of that great scene there maybe isn't the best radio because it is all physical comedy. What you miss, what you can see if you look it up on YouTube or go to our top five list page at filmspotting.net and click on it, you can see Douglas blindfold her, go over, sneak in one last kiss before he says goodbye to her, and then he pops the champagne cork, which Garbo, leaning up against the door, takes as if that's the shot of the gun, and she slinks down as if she's actually been killed. Again, maybe not great radio, but it is great cinema. Nanochka, also one of those major films of the time, four Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture. Garbo got a nomination for Best Actress, Original Story, and Screenplay as well. And it is available on pretty much all of the digital platforms, Amazon Prime, YouTube, iTunes, Vudu, Google Play.
I am so glad you have these sorts of films covered. Romantic comedies, maybe, I don't know if you'd consider this screwball comedy, but those as well.
Close enough.
Such, you know, so close to the height of the cinema that was coming out in the 30s were these sorts of films. The one I'll throw in there that I was also encourage listeners to check out is The Awful Truth with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne as basically a married couple who fall in love in the midst of their own divorce from each other.
Mm-hmm.
It is very screwball-y, so funny. And yeah, this is definitely a genre that need to be represented on one of our lists. Glad you got it covered. My number four is going to be, well, actually, let me share a note we got from a listener, because this is another genre that Kim, very racy Zuckert, emailed in, wanted to make sure that we didn't overlook. She said, the film I hope you will consider goes in the horror category, a very competitive category in the 1930s when you have Dracula, Frankenstein, and Bride of Frankenstein, The Mummy, Freaks, The Black Cat, and on and on and on. This past Halloween, I saw what is now my favorite, The Old Dark House, also known as the movie that Rocky Horror is spoofing. It has wonderful performances by Charles Laughton, Boris Karloff, and terribly young Melvin Douglas, Raymond Massey, and Gloria Stewart, but especially the wonderfully weird Ernest Thesiger, also in Bride of Frankenstein. It's directed by the great James Whale, and it's just a pip. Kim borrowing some appropriate Michael Phillips terminology there. So yes, the horror category is one I did want to include. It was the peak. The 30s was the peak of the Universal monster movies, a lot of which Kim mentioned. I think for me, Bride of Frankenstein is probably the highlight, but also would recommend The Invisible Man, which people are probably interested in now just because of the really good new version of that. But as my representative for this genre, I'm going to go not with a Universal monster movie, but an RKO film. And if anyone has a problem with that, they can take it up with King Kong himself. King Kong is my pick. I know it's a different studio. It's a different sort of monster slash horror movie, but it's so good. This one is one of those that's in my top 20 of all time that I wanted to put it in my starter pack. I just love the old-fashioned special effects here. The stop-motion work by Willis O'Brien is such a marvel. It has a handcrafted elegance and also a rickety charm where it's always reminding you that it's fake, but that's part of what is kind of magical about it in a strange way. And the crucial thing is that O'Brien knew that even spectacle like this needed to be tied to human emotional matters. And so think of a moment where they give so much time and care to this early scene of King Kong fainting after he's been assaulted by these gas bombs on the island. So to put us in sort of the emotional experience of this monster. Now, King Kong, I'll put it out there. It's absolutely racist. It's absolutely sexist. It's problematic with a Empire State Building sized capital P. But it has a lot of interesting ideas roiling around amidst that stuff. Kong also can be seen as standing in for victims of modern colonialism, the way his country has been invaded and he's being exploited. It's also a cautionary environmental fable, humanity despoiling nature and nature biting back. So King Kong has so many metaphorical implications going on beyond the adventure stuff. It really is timeless. And if you haven't seen it for some reason, you can find it on Amazon Prime and YouTube Movies.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the 33 Kong as well. And all good horror movies have that metaphorical resonance, absolutely, I believe. So that makes sense. And that's a genre that I didn't include in my starter pack, so I'm glad that you did. My number four is another romantic comedy, but distinctly of the musical variety. And unlike Ninotchka, which is a movie that's fizzy but still has a foot in the real world of the 1930s, it's actually addressing this idea of communism and what life is like under that rule. This movie's feet, and there are a lot of feet moving in this one, they're all firmly entrenched in the fantasy world. You have to have some Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
Yes, you do.
In your 1930s starter pack. And this is going to be my make good, I think, for all the terrible things I said about him and maybe you as well during our Stanley Donen marathon, right? There was some Audrey Hepburn interaction
we weren't fans of.
Indeed. Maybe the older Fred Astaire. Well, this is Fred Astaire in his prime with Ginger Rogers. They collaborated together 10 times. This is their fourth. It was their biggest box office success and his second biggest box office success overall after Easter Parade, which was another marathon movie of ours. I'm not even going to try to explain the plot of Top Hat. It's so superfluous. It really doesn't matter at all. It basically boils down to a case of mistaken identity and two people who start out not being in love, end up being in love. That's Dale Tremont, Ginger Rogers, and Jerry Travers, who, of course, is playing an American entertainer. They're overseas on holiday, run into each other. A lot of escapades. What's most important is there's a whole lot of singing and dancing. The most famous song, and all the music's great, it's by Irving Berlin. The most famous tune, probably Cheek to Cheek. Mm-hmm. And that is so fun to watch because it's so sparse in terms of the editing. Medium long shots, and it's just about watching these performers and their bodies move together. You're basically just observing the artistry, and there's nothing more needed. But I also go back to a sequence like the Piccolino, which is a tap dance number in Top Hat. And the camera starts by just following their feet as they glide out onto the dance floor, pulling back to reveal their full figures. And again, just lets them go. And I was watching it again today, Josh, and I never really understood why tuxedos, why men's formal dress needed to include tails. And now I do. It's so we can watch them spin when someone like Fred Astaire moves. The women, like Ginger Rogers, every time they twirl, their dress goes up in the air, and it's this wonderfully graceful, elegant maneuver. And you get that same elegance and grace with Astaire when his tails are spinning along with his body. Every time this movie has come up over the years on the show, it's come up a few times. I feel obliged to mention The Purple Rose of Cairo, Mia Farrow's Cecilia escaping the depression by going to the theater and indulging in this carefree luxury and the gracefulness of Fred and Ginger. And you know what? You couldn't go see this movie right now in a movie house, even if it was playing, unfortunately. But I would say there are a few better ways to escape from your couch than watching Top Hat.
Yeah.
And you can do that on Google Play, Amazon Prime, iTunes, and other platforms.
Yeah, if you're looking for a little distraction, a little escape, I don't know that every movie on our list from the 30s is going to serve that function, but definitely these musicals will. And great pick. They are, Fred and Ginger are a genre unto themselves.
Good point.
And so they're also going to be represented on my list just a little bit later. At number three, though, I have The Rules of the Game from 1939. Director Jean Renoir, he also marked this decade, though, from across the Atlantic with The Rules of the Game and Grand Illusion, as well as some notable films that I haven't seen, La Chine, Madame Bovary, and La Bête Humaine. Rules of the Game, here's another top 20 of all time for me. A comedy of manners, a social satire, a treatise on the human condition, basically follows a bunch of aristocrats who gather for a weekend of games and hunting on a country estate. Renoir, he directed, but also co-stars, he also wrote, and he does play one of the sillier guests, I think you can say. So I had seen this, Adam, before we did our Luis Buñuel marathon. And thinking about it now and watching some scenes after that, it strikes me that Rules of the Game is sort of like Buñuel with heart. It's certainly a class satire, but it also has a lot of empathy for these fools. And the tone is closer to something like Pedro Almodovar, I think, than maybe what Buñuel brings to most of the movies we saw. It's also – Rules of the Game is so formally exciting. Even today, Renoir beat Orson Welles and Citizen Kane by a couple of years with his use of deep focus cinematography. There are some fluid tracking shots during this metaphorical rabbit hunt and a really grand tracking shot along a ballroom near the end that encapsulates all of the characters. So The Rules of the Game, that's going to be my Renoir representative. It's pretty widely available via streaming, actually. Criterion Channel, Amazon Prime, Canopy, if you want to go through your library that way, and also YouTube Movies.
Definitely one I considered for my list. His Grand Illusion from 37 is probably still my all-time biggest blind spot. It's a revered movie, does appear on a lot of those sight and sound type lists, and I still need to see it. Maybe sometime over the next few weeks I will get a chance. My number three also comes from 1939. It's Howard Hawks's Only Angels Have Wings. Maybe came up just in passing during our 15th anniversary celebration at the Music Box as we discussed Rio Bravo after watching it with listeners. But you got to have a good action-adventure film from the 30s on this list. And of course, you could go with something like Michael Curtiz and Errol Flynn and Captain Blood, or even Shanghai Express, which we talked about during our Dietrich von Sternberg marathon. But this is the one for me that I think offers the most thrills. And you will also see, in addition to watching Cary Grant in the film and watching Gene Arthur and that great pairing, Rita Hayworth is in it in a breakout role. And it's actually only one of three Hawks films that's currently on the Criterion Collection, at least by my count. His Girl Friday and Red River are the other two. There's an essay that's included with the disc for Only Angels Have Wings from Michael Schregau. And he says this: Angels is a precursor to a Robert Altman film in its bursts of rapid fire, overlapping dialogue, and its offhanded tragicomedy and improvisational snap. In place of plot, Hawks and his favorite screenwriter, Jules Furthman, set up a succession of comic and dramatic situations that pop with laughs, thrills, and frissons. And I should say something about that plot, as it is, it's set in a fictional South American town called Barranca. It's a port town. Jean Arthur is a traveler. She's an entertainer. She ends up meeting Jeff Carter, played by Grant, who is a pilot with a penchant for dangerous missions. He basically runs an airmail company. Thomas Mitchell is in the film as his best friend and business partner, who is called The Kid. And I thought that was interesting, Schregau's comments, because I would have never thought about the film as a precursor to an Altman movie, but I absolutely get it. But the most important part is what he said about what you get in place of plot. For Hawks, and we did talk about this to an extent in looking at Rio Bravo, plot and character are all about action. For Howard Hawks, what does a man or a woman do when confronted with different scenarios, with different tests, whether it's romantic or professional or both? And when those two conflict with each other, as they so often do, through those actions, their true characters are revealed. And I just think Hawke's take on romance, on relationships between men and women, is so fascinating. This movie has one of my all-time favorite proclamations of love from Jean Arthur.
Jeff, you don't have to be afraid of me anymore. I'm not trying to tie you down. I don't want to plan. I don't want to look ahead. I don't want you to change anything. I love you, Jeff. There's nothing I can do about it. I just love you, that's all. I feel the same way about you the kid does. Anything you do is all right with me.
The kid?
Yes, he doesn't ask you for anything or get in your way or bother you, does he?
It drives me nuts.
I was thinking about this great scene in relation to Rio Bravo because we talked about how scared John T. Chance, John Wayne seems of Feathers mm-hmm. and that fear really of any kind of domesticity, in addition to a few other fears, is definitely at play there. But her saying, Jeff, I'm not trying to tie you down. I'm not trying to change you in any way. I just love you. That's all. And I suppose it's tempting to hear that and go, what a fantastic version of love for a man, right? Having a woman just say, you can be whoever you want to be, and I will just be here for it. But honestly, I'm more struck by Hawke's acknowledging that love between men and women is really the same thing. The only difference being that he doesn't sweep the kid up in his arms and kiss him, which is what he does with Jean Arthur. But otherwise, she says it. She has the exact same feelings for him that the kid does. And Grant does get a good joke in there, which is to say, yeah, and he drives me crazy, as she's probably going to do as well. There are some great aerial scenes in this film. In fact, it did make my top five movie flight scenes, a lot of groundbreaking special effects for 1939. It also made, years ago, a top five we did, Breaking Up the Boys Club. Jean Arthur, obviously the character doing that in this great film, which is available on the Criterion Channel, but Amazon Prime, iTunes, and Vudu as well.
Can I add another one to this category?
Please
do. The action adventure. So you mentioned Errol Flynn in Captain Blood, which is just fantastic. I have always loved him in Adventures of Robin Hood as mm-hmm. well. I can remember this was when I was really young, but those who grew up around Chicago maybe recall, I think it was on WGN, there would be family classics, and they were usually Sunday afternoons, I believe, which is when we were often at my grandparents' house. So a lot of the times family classics would be put on, we'd plop in front, and frequently it seems to me Adventures of Robin Hood was playing, and I got to watch Errol Flynn in those sword fights and some great action scenes, and obviously all the charm as well. So yeah, really strong genre in the 1930s, action and adventure. All right, so number two. Well, Charlie Chaplin kind of had to be on this list because the 1930s held two of his greatest features, Modern Times and City Lights. Modern Times is in my top 10 of all time, so that's going to have to be my pick. The movie's enduring relevance is why I value Modern Times so much. This story of Chaplin's little tramp, and this was his last screen appearance as the tramp, just watching this figure being gobbled up by the societal, the economic, and the technological forces of labor certainly spoke to the years right after the Great Depression. But every time I watch it, whether it was 25 years ago or, you know, shortly after the 2008 recession or now in the tumult of today, it just seems to ring even truer. It's like, oh, the movie's about now. It was made then, but it's about now. And plus, this has some of Chaplin's all-time great visual gags, which never get old. The tramp frantically trying to keep up with an assembly line. That moment where he's stuck in a factory machine's giant gears, or even when he's trying to survive a meal via that monstrous feeding machine that keeps stuff in his face. So this is all brilliant comic material and set pieces, as I said, really still applies today. And Modern Times is streaming on the Criterion Channel, Amazon Prime, and you can find it via Canopy.
So some overlap for us at number two. I have Charlie Chaplin as well, but I am going with his other masterpiece, at least one more from the period, City Lights, 1931. It was his prior film to Modern Times. There was a five-year gap between the two, but what a back-to-back set of movies. I think about this movie coming off of Human Bondage. Again, talk about it here in a little bit on the show, but it's the uplifting counter to Of Human Bondage, in that you've got a character, the tramp, who falls in love with this blind girl and kind of becomes obsessed with trying to help her. He finds out that she's going to be evicted, and even though he doesn't have any money himself, he tries to scrape together whatever he can, eventually does come into some cash so that he can try to help them and maybe improve their lives. Now, I have a confession. I haven't seen Modern Times or City Lights since 1998. I can't actually tell you which one I think is the better film. I'm going with City Lights here because of my memories of it, especially that ending. And I'm not going to rehash my essays I wrote back in 1998 when I took a class on silent comedy that compared the films of Chaplin and Keaton. Oh, I could do it. We could get into the place of sentimentality in silent comedies like this and whether or not it truly belongs. I mean, that is the key distinction, really, between Chaplin and Keaton, mm-hmm. is that use of sentimentality. And I think it's why for a time, and maybe we're still in that time, it's become way more fashionable to prefer Keaton to Chaplin because the sentimentality seems a little bit overdone, perhaps, or a little bit schmaltzy and also manipulative. It's easy to do. You could argue that when you pull at the heartstrings a little bit, anybody is going to fall for that, whereas Keaton was more inventive and maybe more ambitious. That might be the case, but when you've got that perfect blend, as I think you do here in City Lights and in Modern Times, of pathos and comedy, then that's Chaplin at his pinnacle. And of course, there's also that great element here, as it is in Modern Times, of social commentary. I mentioned the really famous ending of this movie, but what about the opening, right? Where he is riffing a little bit on the advent of talkies. This had happened 3 years earlier. He doesn't want to make the shift yet, doesn't mm-hmm. think cinema necessarily needs it. He can still tell his stories with the camera. And so he has a nod to that by having this big public forum where statues are being unveiled in honor of peace and prosperity. And keeping in mind, this is 1931. We know what period America is in, and yet there's this big civic display of everyone's benevolence and basically paying tribute to themselves, all these wealthy people, as they unveil this statue. And when they talk, when they make their speeches, there is sound, but it's like Charlie Brown parents talking, right? It doesn't matter what they're saying as far as Chaplin is concerned. But then when they pull off the awning or whatever is covering the statue, of course, what's there sleeping on one of the statues, it is the little tramp. And we see how outraged the crowd is then at what he's doing, that he's somehow besmirching the honor of the statue and their honor, of course, as well. And at one point, as he's trying to get down, Chaplin's face perfectly aligns his nose with the hands of one of the statues. So it looks like he is quite blatantly thumbing his nose at the crowd. The tramp is doing it unintentionally. Chaplin is doing it quite intentionally, trying to mock these people for essentially applauding themselves. You talked about the sight and sound list back in 2012. We didn't get asked to participate in that poll. Maybe 2022, we'll hold out for that. But we still did our own list on the show. If you look at the official 2012 ballot, City Lights was number 50 on the critics list. It was number 30 on the director's list. So if you need a movie to check a box on one of the more revered films ever you maybe haven't seen, this might be your opportunity. And worth noting, back in 1952, when Sight and Sound published the first ever greatest films of all time poll, Bicycle Thieves was number one from De Sica. Chaplin, City Lights was number two. And you can see it on Google Play, YouTube, Amazon, and Vudu.
Yeah, I think to me, if there's a distinction between them, I don't even know if I would say that City Lights is more sentimental. I just find it more romantic. I think, you know, that's the direction mm-hmm. he's more interested in that film. And either way, City Lights, Modern Times, definitely check one of those out if you haven't seen either of them. All right, my number one, and yes, this is, you know, at the top because it's probably personal favorite of mine, Swing Time. I am going back to Fred and Ginger. It was Fred and Ginger's decade. 9 of their 10 films together came out in the 1930s. So they pretty much owned this decade. You can't go wrong with Top Hat, Adam, your pick. Cheek to Cheek, that's an Irving Berlin number.
Yep.
I wrote extensively in my book about Ginger's feather dress in that scene because, yeah, the tuxes are great, but that feather dress is so crucial to their cheek to cheek performance scene. You know, but after our family marathon of their films we did a few years ago, I went ahead and ranked all of them, and I did have Swing Time from 36 slightly ahead of Top Hat for the number one spot. And it might come down to just one number. It might simply be because I think their most exhilarating production number is Never Gonna Dance. The music here by Jerome Kern and the lyrics by Dorothy Fields.
Does she dance very beautifully?
Who?
The girl you're in love with.
Yes. Very.
The girl you're engaged to. The girl you're going to marry.
Oh, I don't know. I've danced with you. I'm never going to dance again.
Though I'm left without a penny, the wolf was discreet.
So you're right, Adam. Let's not worry about the plot. When it comes to these movies, basically the dancers that Astaire and Rogers are playing at this point, they've agreed not to pursue their unrequited romance. But what that does is it sets the emotional narrative for this particular number, which traces an arc. They go from this feigned indifference to a slightly renewed interest to outright passion, and then painful regret, all in a couple of minutes. This all takes place on a ravishing Art Deco nightclub set that features twinned curved staircases that come around to meet at the top of the screen. And as they begin, Astaire and Rogers, they tentatively circle each other until it happens almost without us noticing it, that they slip into unison. And they start flowing in sync, even though they seem to be resisting it somehow at the same time. I could describe the rest of the scene, but really, you know, and you'll want to see how these staircases come into play. So really, you should just watch it. I will note that I think this one has more sensuality that most of their scenes are probably, I wouldn't say missing, but this has definitely is the most sensuality of all of their numbers. And maybe it's because it involves a certain reticence that they're playing with as well. So we will link to that scene, Never Gonna Dance, but you can also watch the full movie at Amazon Prime and at YouTube Movies. I'll just say lastly, Fred and Ginger movies and numbers, usually in their other films, they want you to applaud, right? You're just wowed when it's done. This one, Never Gonna Dance, you feel like letting out this sigh, this like contented sigh. I love it.
I love Swing Time as well. You're right. So many memorable songs and performances in that one. A Fine Romance, The Way You Look Tonight, Pick Yourself Up, honestly, might be my favorite one in Swing Time. So great choice.
And The Way You Look Tonight kind of comes into this number as well, like a little bit of a reprise.
My number one 1930s film for this starter pack is a 1931 movie. It is the classic, I suppose, thriller noir. And we'll get more into that, why I think it's the number one, and it had to be on my list in a second, M, from Fritz Lang, of course, who made Metropolis, among many other films. And you have Chaplin clinging to silent storytelling in City Lights and thumbing his nose, as we said, at talking pictures, in addition to the aristocracy, if you will. You have Fritz Lang here making his first movie with sound and really embracing it. This film, M, doesn't rely on dialogue at all. It still is driven by the camera, absolutely, to tell the story. You can point to moments like the first murder that we see. We don't see it all. It all happens off screen. Or the serial killer that the movie is about. The whole movie is about the hunt for this killer, played by Peter Lorre. When we see him confront that victim earlier, we don't see him at all. What we see is a shadow of him against a white wanted poster, but he uses sound in really interesting key ways. This is a movie that's often credited with being the first one to really employ a leitmotif. It's Peer Gynt in The Hall of the Mountain King. That's how we know the serial killer is around, because we hear him whistling it. And the reason it's number one for me, Josh, is besides being a masterpiece, we're talking about the best films of their respective genres, or certainly some of the best films of their respective genres. And M is a hybrid that was basically the first noir, the first crime procedural, the first serial killer movie. And there's a sequence in it that amounts to what became the first heist sequence that influenced every other bank robbery movie, every other crime movie that followed. I think maybe because we were preparing for our bonus content discussion for our family members on Patreon of Sin City, I was putting this list together and thinking about that film. Listen to what Roger Ebert had to say about it. He said, certainly M is a portrait of a diseased society, one that seems even more decadent than the other portraits of Berlin in the 1930s. Its characters have no virtues and lack even attractive vices. In other stories of the time, we see nightclubs, champagne, sex, and perversion. When M visits a bar, it is to show close-ups of greasy sausages, spilled beer, rotten cheese, and stale cigar butts. And it all does take place within this underworld of Berlin, where these horrible atrocities are being committed by the killer. And then you have the criminals themselves who are out to exact justice on him. So it's a movie that might actually be a nice double feature with Sin City if you were looking for such decadence. And I mentioned that Sight and Sound list from 2012, M, number 56 on the critics list, number 75 on the director's list, and available on almost all of those platforms we've been mentioning, including Amazon Prime and iTunes.
And still blood-curdling. I mean, yeah. it will really unnerve you. Sometimes, as we were saying, these musicals give you some distance and some comfort. This is one film that is going to upset you many, many decades later.
Yeah, it is. Before we get to any other honorable mentions, I'll read some feedback from Zach in Chicago. Wrote in, said, I don't know if Dodsworth from 1936 cracks my top five 1930s movies. There are so many contenders, but I think it might crack my own top five movies about marriage list. What's remarkable is this 1930s William Wyler movie about a disintegrating marriage still seems modern today. It can't escape being a product of its time. It does side more with Walter Houston's husband, especially in its final third, but the wife gets her moments and you understand why she wants to break free. I think she's more sympathetically portrayed than some critics do today. Anyways, if you've never seen it, you need to decide for yourself. It's no marriage story, but, and I think Michael Phillips might have my back here. It makes Kramer versus Kramer look like it was the one made 80 years ago. Thank you very much for that, Zach. And Josh, are there any films that we haven't touched on you definitely want to give a little attention?
Yeah, I definitely want to throw some more titles in case people want to go beyond the 10 we've mentioned and more of a deep dive. I wish my list had more international titles beyond Renoir. Here's one I'll throw out there. Yasujirō Ozu's I Was Born, But. Mm-hmm. Also maybe a good place to start with him as a filmmaker. We've talked about 1939 being such a great year. Here are two more reasons why. You have The Women and you have Stagecoach. How about 42nd Street, a non-Fred and Ginger musical that definitely deserves your time. And a couple more here. We've done a few marathons, Adam. You've mentioned the Dietrich von Sternberg one. I think Shanghai Express, it would be maybe be my representative of that marathon that people might want to check out. We also did a Marx Brothers marathon, and longtime listeners know, probably no surprise that they're not represented in our picks, but I do think if you wanted to get a flavor of their work in the decade,
you'd have to.
One that you would have to, and one that I think we both really liked was A Night at the Opera.
Mm-hmm. My romantic comedy pick, Ninotchka, I had some backups there, including the one you said, Josh, The Awful Truth with Cary Grant and Irene Powell, but also The Thin Man with Myrna Loy and William Powell, and you could go with another Lubitsch as well, Trouble in Paradise, a very good romantic comedy. You mentioned Stagecoach, which surely if you're going to talk about a Western, you have to talk about that John Ford film from the 30s. But how about his Young Mr. Lincoln as a biography? I do really like Barbara Stanwyck in Stella Dallas, King Vidor's melodrama from the time. And in terms of a political drama, there's always Frank Capra's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And yeah, there's probably about 20 other films we'd love to mention, but those are our top five films of the 1930s, our starter pack. We'd love to hear your picks or any other comments. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Oh, I'm sorry, gentlemen. I know I'm being disrespectful to this honorable body. I know that. A guy like me should never be allowed to get in here in the first place. I know that. And I hate to stand here and try your patience like this, but either I'm dead right or I'm crazy.
You wouldn't care to put that to a vote, would you, Senator?
From just a little over 2 years ago, that was our 1930s starter pack. For more top five lists, check out the Film Spotting archive. That's at filmspotting.net/lists. And Josh, that's our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook or on Twitter, Adam is at Film Spotting and I'm at Larson on Film. You can also find us on Letterboxd. Over in the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. You can also vote in the current Film Spotting poll, which has us looking ahead to the release of a new Jane Austen adaptation, Persuasion, starring Dakota Johnson. We're asking, what is your favorite Jane Austen film adaptation? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Debbie will be disappointed about not seeing an early screening of Thor, Love, and Thunder, but Josh, you can make it up to her. Just take her to Minions, The Rise of Gru. Opens wide. It opens wide this weekend.
Don't think that's going to go over.
Mr. Malcolm's List. This is yet another Jane Austen-inspired tale based on the 2009 book of the same name. In limited release, a movie that was the basis of one of my top five questions of the summer movie season, The Forgiven, that's directed by John Michael McDonough, who made the very good Calvary. Ralph Fiennes, Jessica Chastain, star in this film set in Morocco. Also, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. This is a feature-length adaptation of the short video that went viral in 2010. It's with Jenny Slate. Haven't seen it yet, but Josh, as you heard, as well as me on our last edition of Trivia Spotting this past weekend, playing a little pub-style virtual movie trivia with our patrons, number of people highly recommending this film.
I kind of think I have to see this, and I might have to see it soon. It just sounds, I edited today an article about it for Think Christian by Sarah Welch Larson, actually, friend of the show. And just the way she described its quietness and kindness and affirmation and encouragement, it's like I could, you know, I think we could all use something like that right now. Mm-hmm. So I might actually be checking out Marcel this weekend. We'll see.
All right. Next week here on Film Spotting, as we said, it's the summer of Stanwyck. Entry number 2, 1937's Stella Dallas.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.